Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 408, update on September 11th and related subjects, including the Iraq War. This is being recorded on April 27th of the year 2003. Before I get to the main body of the program, the Real Audio show is being archived on Real Audio by WFMU. WFMU.org/Dave Emery, DaveEmory, has more recent programs streaming on Real Audio, and there is a longer URL for download only for the longer shows, linked both to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to SpitfireList.com. There's a link to the For the Record section of SpitfireList.com, the website of the CD and tape duplication service that stocks all of the programs I've done over the years. There are not only descriptions of all of the programs available, but there are long, annotated, detailed descriptions of the various For the Record programs on September 11th and for quite some time before that. And those descriptions are generally up within a week, sometimes as much as 2 weeks, usually within a week of the recording of the program. Now, to the subject material of this broadcast, what we're going to be looking at are some deep political relationships that have in many ways blossomed, not necessarily in the ways that they were foreseen as blossoming, but that have blossomed into some of the situations we have found ourselves in the last several decades. In particular, we are going to be taking a look at relationships that were formed during the Cold War, or in some cases, before and during World War II, relationships that were intended to form coalitions to fight communism, but also in many cases, relationships which led to backfiring or blowback against the United States. In particular, we're going to take a look at relationships which have permitted what I call the Underground Reich and its related Islamo-fascist and secular fascist or Arabo-fascist elements to double on the United States during the Cold War, or after the Cold War, I should say. Basically, relationships formed during the Cold War, as Alan Dulles, a former CIA director, put it, any bastard as long as he's anti-communist. And in this case, some of these anti-communist bastards have turned out to be very deeply and effectively American anti-American bastards as well. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article, specifically an obituary, from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, April 24th of 2003. This is an AP obituary, Dateline New York. It's the obituary for James Critchfield, the CIA go-between with Nazi officials. It reads in part as follows. James H. Critchfield, a powerful CIA insider during the Cold War whose anti-Soviet missions included recruiting former Third Reich operatives and supporting the Iraqi political power that put Saddam Hussein in power, died Tuesday from pancreatic cancer in Williamsburg, Virginia. He was 86. Mr. Critchfield, a decorated U.S. Army officer during World War II, was best known in intelligence circles as the CIA's liaison to the Galen Organization, a group of former Third Reich intelligence and military officials initially recruited by the U.S. Army because of their purported knowledge of the Soviet Union. That group turned out to be tainted with fabricators, double agents, and Nazi war criminals, and has been the focus of a task force created to oversee the 1999 Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act, which has resulted in the biggest declassification of U.S. intelligence records in history. Mr. Critchfield himself drew parallels between the moral compromises made at the end of World War II with his recommendation in the early 1960s that the United States support the Ba'ath Party, which staged a 1963 coup against the Iraqi government that the CIA believed was falling under Soviet influence. By the way, I would note a couple of things in passing before I continue. In the first place, the Galen Organization was indeed a direct outgrowth of the Third Reich's national security establishment, but far more, of course, than is indicated here, it actually became the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, later becoming the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and finally, and this is very important, finally, it manifested itself into the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the official intelligence service for the Federal Republic of Germany. And through bureaucratic inertia, it maintained basically its Nazi character, albeit in a somewhat reserved and clandestine sense, in the post-war period. So when noting the Galen organization here and Mr. Critchfield's role as a liaison with it, note that this is far more than just a bunch of Nazi collaborators. That, but far, far more. Also note that the Ba'ath Party of Saddam Hussein was recruited by Mr. Critchfield, basically was Mr. Critchfield worked with this organization in order to ally it with the U.S., and this for anti-communist purposes. And also note that there was a 1963 coup against an Iraqi government considered to be too pro-Soviet. There was a coup in the United States by related elements that same year for a disturbingly similar rationalization. Continuing here with the account of Mr. Critchfield, quote, speaking of the Iraqi 1963 coup, we knew perhaps 6 months beforehand that it was going to happen, he said during an interview with the Associated Press last month. Mr. Critchfield described Hussein as a minor and peripheral figure in the Ba'ath Party at the time. He did not become a force in the party until the late 1960s and seized full power in 1979. You have to understand the context of the time and the scope of the threat we were facing, Mr. Critchfield said. That's what I say to people who say, you guys in the CIA created Saddam Hussein, unquote, skipping down. With the growing political importance of Middle East oil, he became the CIA's National Intelligence Officer for Energy in the early 1970s, then an energy policy planner at the White House. After retiring from the CIA in 1974, Mr. Critchfield became a consultant. By the way, it was just those, just such ex-CIA, now retired, working for the petroleum industry that facilitated the relationship that led to the deliberate manipulation of oil prices in 1979 to help to destabilize Jimmy Carter. We talked about that in For the Record 214, among other shows. Now, note that James Critchfield helped to organize the anti-communist Ba'ath Party, which was both the political nurturing ground and the eventual tool for Saddam Hussein. Although Saddam Hussein was strongly influenced by Stalin and some of his bureaucratic and methodological ideas, it's important to note that the Ba'ath Party is sort of an Arabo-fascist or sort of an Arab manifestation of the German National Socialist Party, hence its anti-communism. And we have noted in the past the influence of Saddam's maternal uncle, Khairullah al-Tufah, on the development of his ideology. We're going to touch briefly now on the fascist political antecedents of Saddam Hussein, and note again that this the rationale for recruiting Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party and the Galen organization was not at all dissimilar. This from the Financial Times of April 12th through 13th of 2003, an article by Faleh A. Jabbar, and he is an Iraqi exile who left Iraq in 1978. This is called End of a Dictator and of Saddam Hussein's Political Inspiration and Heritage, he writes. The tyrant who styled himself a 20th century Saladin was born in a small village organized around its tribe. An orphan, Saddam was brought up by his maternal uncle, a disgrace according to Iraqi tribal norms which cherish paternal descent. In his adolescence, he embraced a form of Arabist ideology influenced by Nazi ideals which was advocated by his uncle. As a young man, he developed terrorist skills and took part in the attempt on the life of the Iraqi Premier General Abdul Karim Qasim in 1959. Next, he mastered clandestine and mass politics, and finally, he worshipped Stalin and his iron rule. So again, note the influence of Khairullah al-Tufah on Saddam Hussein, and note many of the pieces of information in the past about the alliances between Saddam Hussein and other secular Arabo and Islamo-fascist elements in the Middle East and the Third Reich in its pre-World War II, World War II, and post-World War II underground manifestations. And to sum up very briefly an argument that I've been presenting at considerable length in connection with the Iraq War and September 11th, it is a complex one, but I've been talking about proxy war in the Middle East and about its economic effects on the United States, and I have talked about the German-Iraqi alliance and the use of the Iraqi regime, among others, as a proxy warrior element against the United States. In that consideration, the following comes from the Daily Electronic Telegraph, the Daily Telegraph from the United Kingdom. This is from April 20th of 2003. This article is by David Harrison in Baghdad. It's headlined, German Spies Offered to Help Saddam in Run-Up to War. It reads in part, Germany's intelligence services attempted to build closer links to Saddam's secret service during the build-up to war last year. Documents from the bombed Iraqi intelligence headquarters in Baghdad obtained by the Telegraph reveal. They show that an agent named as Johannes Wilhelm Hoffner, described as a, quote, new German representative in Iraq, unquote, who had entered the country under diplomatic cover, attended a meeting with Lieutenant General Taher Jalil Habush, the director of Iraq's intelligence service. During the meeting on January 29, 2002, Lieutenant General Habush says that the Iraqis are keen to have a relationship with Germany's intelligence agency, quote, under diplomatic cover, unquote, adding that he hopes to develop that relationship through Mr. Hoffner. The German replies, My organization wants to develop its relationship with your organization, unquote. In return, the Iraqis offered to give lucrative contracts to German companies if the Berlin government helped to prevent an American invasion of that country. Skipping down, the meeting between the Iraqi and German agents took place some 6 months before Chancellor Schroeder's Social Democrat-led government began its policy of direct opposition to the idea of an American and British-led war against Iraq. The policy was adopted in the heat of last year's German general election campaign, at a time when the Social Democrats were widely predicted to lose the contest. Mr. Schroeder was re-elected as chancellor last September, largely because of the popularity of his government's outspoken opposition to the war against Iraq. That apparently verbatim account of the meeting between Lieutenant General Habush and Mr. Hoffner was among documents recovered by the Telegraph in the rubble of the Iraqi intelligence headquarters in Baghdad, which was heavily bombed. By the way, I would note that the successful prosecution of that war is very possibly going to coalesce as George Bush's major tool for his re-election. So it's interesting here and in some ways significant that it was Schroeder's opposition to the war that got him elected, re-elected in Germany, and it is Bush's support for and successful prosecution, at least militarily, of the war that may very well end up getting him elected in the United States. More about the Habush Hoffner, Iraqi, German intelligence liaison here. And note again how anti-communism basically helped to nurture the post-World War II perpetuation of National Socialism and Fascism in Germany, among other places, and in Iraq. And note that after the end of the Cold War, some of the relationships, some of the fascist elements that were nurtured for the purposes of anti-communism have now come back to haunt the United States, and in some cases, in alliance with each other. Returning again to the April 20th Telegraph article from 2003. During that meeting, Lieutenant General Habush tells the German agent that Iraq has, quote, big problems with Britain and the United States, quote, We have problems with Britain because it occupied Iraq for 60 years and with America because of its aggression for 11 years, he says. He adds, however, that Iraq has no problems with Germany and suggests that Germany will be rewarded with lucrative contracts if it offers international support to Iraq. When the American conspiracy is finished, we will make a calculation for each state that helped Iraq, that helps Iraq in its crisis, unquote. He also urges Mr. Hoffner to lobby the German government to raise its diplomatic mission in Baghdad to full ambassadorial level. Mr. Hoffner says that it would be a decision for the German foreign ministry, But Germany's diplomatic presence in the Iraqi capital made it easier for him to enter Iraq because he was able to use diplomatic cover. Last night, a spokesman for the German government said it was well known, unquote, that it had been offered lucrative contracts by Baghdad, providing it maintained an anti-Iraq war stance. Iraq made these kinds of promises before the war and praised Germany for its position, he said. By the way, I would note that Iraqi oil wealth and its derivative lucrative situation for any German or other corporate contractors that can develop a relationship with Iraq was one of the factors that led to some of the weapons contracts, including the old Degussa IG Farben NUKEM nuclear deal between Germany and Iraq that led not to the active production of nuclear weapons, but rather which led to the transfer of software that could be used for the mass production of nuclear weapons if the appropriate materials were acquired. As I noted in For the Record 395 in noting this line of heritage between corporate Germany of the Hitler period, corporate Germany of the present period, and also of some of the basically National Socialist and anti-Semitic doctrine that helped to unite those, I noted that with the transfer of such software, that would be almost impossible to detect and much, much easier to disseminate and to deploy and to proliferate than would be hardware or fissionable material. We're going to look at an article now which in many ways embodies some of the blowback that appears to have been taking place, and in particular, how some of the German-American relationships nurtured during the Cold War appear to have been used by the Underground Reich and elements related to the Bormann Organization to double on the United States. There have been a number of very interesting articles that have been put together by Daniel Hopsicker, the author of Barry and the Boys, and on his Mad Cow Morning News website, a very important website to check out. It's at www.madcowprod.com, MadcowProd. There are a number of very, very important allegations concerning Mohammed Atta's German connections. In For the Record 404 and number 405, we took a look at allegations from Daniel Hopsicker's research that many of Mohammed Atta's associates in Florida when he was taking flight training were not only Germans, but children of the German elite. Very suggestive not only of Andreas Strassmeier, the son of Gunter Strassmeier, but also suggestive of Bormann/Underground Reich participation. Note the following. This is from the Mad Cow Morning News website, dated April 24th of 2003. It's Dateline Venice, Florida, headlined, Atta worked for Elite U.S.-German Exchange Program, a world exclusive by Daniel Hopsicker, and be sure to check this out. For at least 4 years while living in Hamburg during the 1990s, terrorist ringleader Mohammed Atta was part of a joint venture between the U.S. and German governments, the Mad Cow Morning News has learned, an elite international exchange program run by a little-known private organization with close ties to powerful American figures like David Rockefeller and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. The jointly funded government effort picked up the tab for Atta on sojourns in Cairo, Istanbul, and Aleppo in Syria during the years 1994 and 1995, and employed him as a tutor and seminar participant during 1996 and 1997. Moreover, Atta's financial relationship with the U.S. government effort may even have extended back to his initial move from Egypt to Germany in 1992, after being recruited, unquote, in Cairo by a mysterious German couple dubbed the hijacker's sponsors, unquote, in a recent news account in the Chicago Tribune. In the years before he became a terrorist ringleader, unquote, Atta was enjoying the patronage of a government initiative overseen by the U.S. State Department and the German Ministry of Economic Cooperation and Development, the German equivalent of the U.S. agency currently supervising the secret bidding race for tens of billions of dollars for post-war reconstruction contracts in Iraq, the Agency for International Development. news that Mohammed Atta had been on the payroll of an elite international program known as the Congress Bundestag Program, unquote, first surfaced a month after the September 11th attack in a brief, seven-line report by German newspaper Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung on October 18th, 2001, under the headline, Atta was tutor for scholarship holders, unquote. The story quoted a spokesman for Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft, described as a, quote, German International Further Education Organization, unquote, as having admitted paying Hamburg cadre principal Atta as a scholarship holder and tutor, as the spokesman put it, between 1995 and 1997. Once again, the organization repeating that, the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft, described as, quote, a German International Further Education Organization. Let's continue. But the shocking revelation that Atta had therefore been on the payroll of a joint U.S.-German government program was concealed by the newspaper through the simple expedient of neglecting to mention that the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft was merely a private entity set up to administer an official U.S. and German government initiative. By the way, Karl Duisberg is described here later as an industrialist who headed up the Bayer Corporation. Bayer was one of the key elements of IG Farben. Karl Duisberg was the head of IG Farben. He precipitated the coalescing of the German dyestuff companies into IG Farben during World War I, and also was instrumental in developing the prototypical forced labor campaign that not only helped to propel German industry in World War I, but that was the prototype for the slave labor programs that were used by the Third Reich and IG Farben in particular in World War II. More about CDS International. That's the U.S. end of the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft. The U.S. end of the program is run out of an address at United Nations Plaza in New York by CDS International. The letters stand for Karl Duisberg Society, which is also the name of its German counterpart in Cologne, the Karl Duisberg Gesellschaft. Both are named for Karl Duisberg, a German chemist and industrialist who headed the Bayer Corporation during the 1920s. Speaking of the many powerful people who have backed this organization, Henry Kissinger, to cite just one example, addressed over 100 international business leaders at a dinner at the River Club of New York on June 2, 1987, organized by and celebrating CDS International. Kissinger congratulated CDS International on its 20 years of service in keeping close business ties not only between Germany and the United States, but more recently, through career development programs for participants from other countries as well. Skipping down, CDS International, states the organization's literature, provides opportunities for young German professionals. Quote, these young German engineers earn real-world experience and are given assignments to contribute from the start, unquote, a German program enthused in a newspaper interview. The spokesman neglected to mention the fact that the program's most recent graduates' real-world experience includes murdering almost 3,000 people in less than 2 hours in New York City. Skipping down again. Having powerful friends in such high places may also explain the curious omissions in a second story about Mohammed Atta's time in Germany, which recently appeared in the Chicago Tribune, headlined, 911 halts hijacker sponsors, German couple talks of living with pilot Atta, unquote. The March 7, 2003 story describes the 1992 meeting in Cairo, which led Mohammed Atta to move to Hamburg between Atta and a German couple, which the paper does not name, who ran an international student exchange program, which the paper also leaves anonymous. During a visit to the Egyptian capital in the fall of 1991, said the Tribune, the German couple had stayed with friends who knew Atta's father, a Cairo lawyer, and his father's friends had then introduced the German couple to Atta himself. Quote, Atta, who had recently graduated with a degree in architectural engineering from the University of Cairo, told the couple he wanted to study architecture in Germany, but he had no particular idea where he should go, the paper reported. Atta, though the article neglects to mention it, had found himself with, quote, no particular idea where he should go, unquote, because although he had studied engineering at prestigious Cairo University, he had not fared well enough to gain admission to its graduate school. In this first conversation, we suggested he continue his studies in Hamburg and offered him a place to live at our house, the paper quotes the German wife telling investigators from the BKA, the German equivalent of the FBI. Atta, she states, accepted their offer right away. Why did an unnamed German couple running an unnamed international exchange program leap at the chance to engage a young man who is not even considered promising enough to gain entrance to a local Cairo graduate school? The Tribune doesn't say. After studying German in Cairo, Atta arrived in the country on July 24, 1992, according to investigators' records, and then lived rent-free for at least the next 6 months in the couple's home in a quiet middle-class neighborhood. It is more than curious that although Tribune correspondent Stevenson Swanson cites the German couple for having played such an important role in Atta's move to Germany, unquote, he never gives their names nor that of the organization they worked for. But since just 2 years later Atta was on the payroll of the Congress Bundestag program, it is reasonable to conclude that this same government-funded program was responsible for bringing him to Germany in the first place under the aegis of an unnamed German couple. Its elite sponsors are apparently powerful enough to keep the organization's name out of the papers, or at any rate, out of the Chicago Tribune. When Atta returned for a three-month visit to Cairo in 1995, the Egyptian government was in the midst of cracking down viciously on Islamic fundamentalists. Yet oddly, Atta chose this time to grow a beard, traditionally a sign of a devout Muslim man, but in this case also assumed to have been a defiant political gesture chosen to register his disgust at the secular elite that ruled his homeland. His two German traveling companions later reported that Atta told him he would not be cowed by the country's fat cats, who they said Atta believed were criminalizing religious traditionalists while bowing shamefully to the West in foreign and economic policies. In that type of relationship and the German-Iraqi relationship, some of the anti-British and anti-American and anti-colonialist sentiment that was utilized by the Third Reich is evident. The programs I've recorded over the years are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire, one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Email mail at spitfirelist.com. Visit their website at www.spitfirelist.com. By the time you hear this program, there will be a detailed annotated description of the program in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Be sure to follow the links in that description to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM, which have virtually the entire For the Record series available for download and or streaming on Real Audio. The first airing of each For the Record program takes place at 9 p.m. on Monday night on KKUP. Visit their website for instructions on how to listen at www.kkup.com. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 408, Update on September 11th and Related Matters. This has been recorded on April 27th of the year 2003. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.